way.
Yeah, okay.
Because I think it might help both of us. The their list, all sorts of things came to mind. And apropos of that, where we were earlier, there's a nice illustration of the effects of the written word on speech in Eliot's Wasteland. And it's the clue or cue comes from his use of the name Mrs. Equitone. But I heard when Eliot reads it, when he's recording the poem, and by the way, there's an area of study, the effects of the poet's recordings in our time have been tremendous. But when he records it, he simply reads the lines, "Tell dear Mrs. Equitone, I bring the horoscope myself. One must be so careful these days." You see, you mimic the effect of typography with the voice, Equitone. You see, even the voices on that tape are close to printing because of the equality. The amount of variation in rhythm and so on is slight compared to any... Well, you take Joyce's opening of his recitation. "Will you know or don't you, Kennetor, have it? I told you every tellin' has a tailin', and that's the he and the she of it." Now, this is a non-literate speech. The brogues of the world, or dialects of the world, Negro or otherwise, are not affected by print. No leveling off of nuance and pattern, you see. That's why they can perform in the musical world so much more freely than the literate man. But this Mrs. Equitone is really a very useful bit because the whole British upper class mimic, with voice, they mimic the world of printing. This puts the lower classes way down because they still retain many of the characteristics of pre-print in their voices. So the class structure in England is quite simply simulating print with the voice. "Tell dear Mrs. Equitone, I bring the horoscope myself." Boy, does that fix people. It really, you know, puts the clamps on. It's comical, of course.
Would you say the effect of recordings on poetry or the poets reading poetry has had?
Well, it has involved readers in the whole poetic process as never before. Oh, heavens. When you actually hear Eliot or Joyce or Dylan Thomas reading that stuff, why, it makes you feel that it's a normal part of human speech and behavior to be poetic. Oh, sure. And I think you can really translate the word creative or poetic quite simply into probe, and that at all times any creative person is probing, exploring his environment. And the ordinary person doesn't probe. He reposes in the environment, he wraps it around himself like a familiar setting or chair or something. But the poet tends to be a bit of a delinquent, sleuth, Bogart, Bond, explorer. But I heard that Jack Benny show revived recently. Not a Fred Allen show, I'd like to hear a Fred Allen show again. What amazed me about the Jack Benny revival show was the tremendous speed with which he delivered his gags and his words. Very hi-fi, very fast. Whereas now, since TV, he's slowed down. He smiles slow. No hurry. The fast gag man of the radio days couldn't exist on TV.
You know, an interesting comparison of two shows... Norman Corwin did a thing called On a Note of Triumph. It was written to be played the night after the end of the war. It was all symbolic, all poetry and so forth. You listen to that today, it leaves you cold. You listen to an actuality broadcast of the British, that the British made, a whole series of records, you're as involved in that as if it were happening today. It's all reality material.
Broadcaster was it, the reality broadcaster?
Well, the reality broadcasts are interviews with the people on the battlefield, the sounds of the battle, and so forth. The other is poetry and music relating
to
it.
Well, it's packaged. The reality broadcasting, you see, isn't packaged. And packaging really means putting something around something. It's container corp. But in England, before the war, the thing grew up Alec Comfort, the poet, was one of the inspirers of the movement called Mass Observation, in which the sort of reality broadcasting was done. They had teams of people who were simply going out, talking to people casually in ordinary situations about what was happening. And that idea of the informal, the unpackaged, but the Corwins, or the, who's the old voice of NBC, or from the
Mark.
Victory at Sea,
Mark.
Oh, who's, he's still around. The
you're not thinking Merle and Friendly here. No.
The voice that they used on the Victory at Sea.
By the way, the Orson Welles
yeah.
Broadcast of that invasion from Mars, I remember hearing it the night it was on, and I have a recording of that program that I listened to just a few months ago. It is so ridiculous and so uninvolving now, and yet it had the country in its clutches at that moment.
Yeah, but
there again is style.
Well, I'll come around to something like that in a moment. You know Glenn Gould. Did I get
that? Yes, I saw that piece, and I felt that he was searching for something, but he had so many errors in that. He was, he is still related to his performance of music.
He
was recognizing certain problems.
He feels that the concert hall, though, is not the right place for the performer anymore. But I'm sure he hasn't straightened out all the...
Yeah, but I don't think he's as free as Jimmy in saying, let's go out to the street and go to the bus terminal or let's...
Oh, quite true. Oh, he's still a very academic performer. One of the areas that we might be able to illustrate on June 27 would be the effect of sound on changing photographic methods. When sound movies came in, they changed the whole photographic pitch. And the difference we're talking about between radio and TV sound, between involving and uninvolving, is a difference between silence and talkies. Regarding the photography, as far as I've noticed, had to be stepped up to much higher intensity with sound. You see, when you're listening to sounds, you form a visual track all the time. And when you're looking at pictures, you form a soundtrack all the time. The human being provides one.
I bought color TV last week, and I noticed a fantastic difference between the two. First up, I put the two of them in front of my daughter and asked which one would you like. She picks the color.
Uh-huh.
But apart from that, I find that the people that I used to watch the Johnny Carson show late at night, the people were celebrities on the black and white. On color, they're real people. I can see the shading, I can see the skin, I see them as real people. I can see the color of their lips and so forth, as opposed to black and white, where I supply an image of them. I supply the rest of the image in my feelings.
Mm-hmm.
And I find that they are more real as people and less of this great figure with color.
By the way, there's a phrase, this might have some use.
Has the message changed?
My relation to color has changed. First,
it's a new medium.
It's much easier on my eyes.
Color is not the old medium. It's a brand new medium. It will change everything, including the content, in a short time. That's where Batman came from. The new color medium requires the cartoon world, not pictures. And you see, there's a phrase... well, TV...
Why do you say that?
Well, there's a phrase, what is called information theory. It's not a very useful phrase because it misleads people. Information theorists will say, in a photograph, there is no information, too many data. In a cartoon, lots of information, very few data. What they mean by information is structure, just outline. Now, TV is by comparison with photography, is information. It's cartoon.
Something you did at your Channel 13 thing gave me an idea that I bet would blow a certain type of commercial apart. Remember you had that drawing of the outline shapes of people and the numbers in them? Remember that one? You know, for instance, Life magazine will have a picture of 30 people, the graduating class of Cornell of 1914. Then they will have a little drawing of just the shapes of the people standing there with numbers and their names below it.
Yeah.
All right. You take these testimonial commercials and you take and just have the outline of the person and they're talking about how it cured their headache, you will find that people will be much more involved than seeing the person really in full camera, in full picture, telling about their headache. Because they can paint their own picture of the person the other way, in that shape. They will also find that it will not be a specific person, but it will be, if the sound is convincing and real, it'll say that this is anybody and it's real. Whereas the other way, it becomes just one person and real. And it's a totally different...
But you see, the reason the kids will buy cartoons any time ahead of picture books is just that. So much has been left out. There's big space for them to get in.
Ambiguity.
That's another way of getting into the act. You see, the clear, distinct, precise scientific statement leaves no room for anybody to get in. Stay away. It excludes. Anything specialist and intense excludes. Now, the cartoon includes. And color includes even more than black and white, because, you see, the eye, it is the periphery of the eye that sees black and white and movement. The center of the eye, the cones, see color. And that's much more involving than movement and black and white. So color will have a complete transform the whole programming of TV eventually, and will change. It's a new environment too in the outside world. And
it affects the way you see.
Have you watched the fire in black and white and the fire in color on TV?
No, I haven't seen anything like that. What do you mean, the fire?
A fire.
A
building burning down.
But it reminds me of Johnny Cage's remark, remember? When in trouble in New York, the cops told Johnny.
That was Tony's remark.
You told me. Ah, well now look. I'd like to be able to track that down a little further in case.
No, I told you that a cop one day told me that if you ask for, if you yell help, if you're in a lobby and someone comes up and attacks you and you yell help, he says, no one will come. He says, yell fire, and all the doors will open.
That's right. Now, you see, this is...
Well, I didn't do that, but I wanted to bring out some images.
But you see,
images
this is a nice way of getting it hot and cool. Yelling help is cool and is involving, and nobody wants to get involved anymore. They are already involved far too much. But if you say fire, they'll rush in because there's no involvement there. You just put the fire up and beat it.
Well, I saw it on another...
Literature is black and white. It's very hard to see color in literature. But Maxim Gorky has an essay on fire. And you see color in that entire goddamn essay.
Well, that could be.
Now, I would like
to put color.
The image of a building burning down in color in front of your eyes in black and white. And I'd like to see how you react to that.
Uh-huh. Oh, well, my reaction wouldn't be any different from anybody's reaction.
I have the idea that one is a danger you're staying away from.
Well, it's literally. The funny thing is, here is a pun in a nonverbal form. The fire is really saying a very hot situation does not involve people. They get back. They don't feel involved. Help means you must hurry in here and involve yourself.
Well, that's only one aspect of what's going on. Because, look, realistically, if someone yells fire, I want to not be in danger. If they yell help, there's the chance of my being in danger.
Of course, but that's involvement. Now, when they yell help, that means they want you to get involved in their life.
Yes, the involvement I accept.
Well, no, most people don't accept it. They don't want to have anything to do with it.
What I mean by accepting is that I accept that part of your statement. The other part of the...
Fire? You mean you might...
come out because of the fire because they want to protect themselves.
But the protection takes the form of detaching themselves. Don't you see? As in any hot medium, you detach yourself. You become objective. You become a spectator. You don't get involved.
Yes, but
the more you hot up,
this house is burning down. I want to get the hell out of it.
That's not involvement. You see, it's a hot medium
you
want to. That's all right. But that's true of all hot media. You want to get away from them.
Yeah.
That's the point. So
that's why they say shut off that radio.
Yeah, that's hot.
You want to get away from it.
No, but the reason that people will help with a fire is quite simply, of course, they don't want to get involved in a fire, in the sense that it might surround them. On the other hand, a fire is a very impersonal thing, whereas a person in need of help is in a very personal problem. And fire is not personal. It's purely objective. You rush in with an extinguisher, anything available, and you put it out. But there's no personal involvement.
How about fire as an object of art? Suppose I had a fire museum. You'd come in, and immediately I'd be burning wood.
Yeah,
and then I'd
be
burning sulfur.
Wonderful.
It'd be a beautiful thing. I'd have every
You could have a great spectrum of experiences. But, there's in music, there's a great range of fire music.
Isn't it possible that we react to fire with feelings that we never knew we had before?
No, from the time you first burned your fingers, you have all sorts of feelings available for fire.
But isn't a feeling for fire something that might be handed down in our genes?
It may be, but it isn't necessary to suppose that. It's quite simply that physically you try to get away from it as much as possible. And any hot form of experience invites people to get away. By the way, there's a famous old story about the north wind and the sun decided to have a little battle about who could exert the most power on something. I read this since I was literally in grade one. And the north wind blew like fury, and the guy merely tightened up his clothes on. Then the sun came out and beamed on him, and off went the clothes. But... the hot is much more inclined to get people away, detached. Print is hot. It detaches people. Handwriting is not hot. It involves people. It's cool.
You know, I wanted to have a message on a commercial, and I just wanted to have the hand writing the message over the picture. Just writing it.
That's TV. The scanning finger is writing on the wall.
If you were to pick up a bottle on a shoreline and you pulled out a typewritten message with the word help, you wouldn't be as involved as a handwritten message.
No.
Circumstance. There's so many.
If you want to work at that, strictly, that's the red herring department, which you might well encounter on the seashore. But the bottle. You see, the bottle, the message in a bottle is like something overheard, not heard. Something overheard.
Is that what we want in advertising?
That.
The feeling of it?
Oh, just a moment.
Wouldn't you drop in Life Magazine a handwritten ad
just a moment. The overheard message, if you hear somebody in the barbershop saying something to somebody about something terrific, that has a far greater effect than somebody telling you something.
Would you let me do one of my columns in handwriting in your magazine?
Yes.
Okay, The overheard
is far more potent than what you hear. These awful noises that come off the commercials are so hot, they drive anybody to cover. And they should be cooled down. Very cool.
You know, I have two other things that are interesting for you. This warden had a problem with too many guys wanting to go into solitary confinement.
This is like the Trappists. They now got guys who want to get off and be hermits.
So what they did, the warden decided, since everybody had bread and water, that the water would be served in baby bottles. And they cut down the guys that went into, 4% or something. Guys that wanted to go into, did things that got them into solitary.
Why didn't they use diapers also for these guys?
Dress them in diapers and
great deterrent, indeed.
Well, Wingate Payne's office, it's done in fur, wall to ceiling fur, and he goes in there for about 20 minutes a day. Back to the womb.
Fur below.
Fur
away.
That's interesting. What's it sound like?
But look,
you want to try an interview on there?
Trying to think, Tony, for my benefit on June 27th, of some way of illustrating the effect of sound on pictures. In the section on movie, I do have a few observations on it, and pointed out that, as far as I know,
I have a beautiful way of showing this.
Yeah, good.
An exquisite way. I can take a scene where, I did this for the traffic commissioner. I have a scene where they show pictures that are cuts. The whole thing falls apart if you put the actual sound of what's happening there. The minute I put a church bell tolling against this, everything falls into place.
Wonderful. By the way, notice that bell, like for whom the bell tolls, bell is a great big communal sound, all-embracing, and has been so used for many centuries. It's a communal image. for participation. It's not a message beamed at anybody. Oh, yeah, the little chapel bell, the high-pitched bell, that's an immediate message to a particular sector or segment, come now. But the big bell is not for that purpose. But, gee, that'll be great, Tommy. That's what we need. I'm sure it would be possible from the library at Museum of Modern Art to have them extract for before and after effects in pictures. One of the things, you see, the Russians have never been able to make pictures since talkies. They were the great maestros of film as art in the days of the silence. They are themselves a very ear-oriented people, and when sound came in, it intensified the visual image to a point that they found utterly uncongenial. And they never did make pictures again. They still haven't made pictures since sound. And they are, however, beginning to make pictures with higher visual intensity, and may eventually begin to experiment again with pictures. But it was only at a certain level of sensory mix, as it were, that they could be experimental with film.
Did you want a comment from Marshall in the manual?
Sure, like it.
You want to tell him what you'd want? Say something in this
relation? Does he want to finish with his notes? I'm just fascinated by what this triggered in his mind.
I'm just running through a few notes, but what were you going to suggest?
We have an annual, I don't know if you're aware of
it. And this is an annual for which enterprise?
Photography.
Photography, I
see. John is the editor of Popular Photography.
I see.
You'll send Marshall a subscription.
Sure. I think you have one coming up there.
Good.
I was a fellow who wrote you a note saying I would trade you Tony Schwartz.
I haven't been home since then, as it were. I haven't really
and
sat.
You got to him before.
Yeah, I haven't sat down at home really since that time. I did get to look at your note. I didn't realize it was the same guy. But anyway, you were going to.
He also did the editorial on you, Soup for Breakfast.
Huh?
I don't know if you're aware
no,
of that.
I don't know.
I'll send you that.
But what had you in mind then for the annual, or possibly?
I was intrigued and baffled by your chapter, Photography, the Brothel Without Walls.
No, that was movie, not photo.
Have you reread the chapter lately? You don't pinpoint it.
No, a movie, Brothel Without Walls, but that was the subheading of the movie chapter. I forgot what the subhead of the photo chapter was. Wasn't brothel.
Photography, the Brothel Without Walls.
And not, what did I have for movies then?
Is there a copy?
I have a copy.
Oh, well.
Well, I went across the United States in a flying short course, and I probably sold more damn books to people who hate me now from reading it, getting very upset about what's happening in the world of vision. And I used quotes out of this thing. Now, the Brothel Without Walls had me thoroughly baffled.
Oh, well. It was based on some observations made by René Clair, in which he pointed to the strange power of the photograph or the movie to penetrate the world of flesh and the textures of flesh. And so this is a very brothel-like dimension, the working with flesh and textures. As movie, paradoxically, as the photo has improved, it has become less and less visual and more tactile, textural. The more hi-fi you go with pictures, the more you get texture surfaces. You penetrate wood, cloth, stone. You do a hi-fi study of stone, and you don't get visual, you get tactile imagery. In the world of flesh, the photograph is, in that sense, brothel. Is that what it sells? Brothel? Is that Brothel Without Walls?
Well, the photograph, Brothel Without Walls.
Yeah. What do I have for movies?
Well, I'm looking for the movie. Movies, the real world, R.E.
Ah, okay. I forgot.
I never open a book again
once it's published. I never do.
I can sympathize with you. I have one of those, too. Now, if the movie is a Brothel Without Walls, what is a still photograph?
Well, we're now talking about photography as brothel, yeah.
Yeah, well, this is what...
I know. We're now talking about that still.
All right. You said that the Brothel Without Walls concerns motion picture, and here it is, the photograph.
The brothel. It concerns it in the sense of flesh textures. you can penetrate, and there is no privacy conceivable or possible with photograph. It invades. As the telephone invades the ear world anywhere, the photo can invade any part of human life, inside the body, outside the body, so on. And it's simply this invasion of textures and surfaces that is in question. You understand that these statements are intended to be very controversial. I never make a statement as just a nice packaged piece of information about anything. I would never bother to say anything like that.
I accept it as such, and I admire you for it.
But I know, but I do it deliberately and experimentally.
Well, and that an English teacher should lead us in visual communications is just fascinating.
Oh, well.
And I doubt that you've ever made a film or taken a picture.
Not especially. I've taken a few, sure.
Come in as the critic of our area, and in that you're raising the questions in our mind, and you're very important for this, but I'm not here to...
Don't, please.
Now, is the Canadian the leader in the image world today? The Canadian is a mass figure
I should doubt it. We have a mounted policeman up there, and that's about all. And the Dulin. Don't forget the Dulin.
Dulin, McLaren, the Canadian Film Board
Norrie Fry.
Film Board and Stills.
Norrie Fry, the archetypal expert.
An American, a Frenchman, and an Englishman across your photo exhibit at Expo 67.
Well, that's, you know, that they would never draw on local talent for anything that they wanted for exotic effect. Natural. However, who cares? But that's nothing paradoxical about that. Hey, I want to tell you something. I've got a lot of other notes here. We've got to get going, you see. We have an appointment. But here is one that may have some meaning. It happened a few days ago in Toronto. A little picture in the paper. Some school kids had got together, dug up some money from the class, and they bought an out-of-door Ruddy Coaster sign on which they had written, "Happiness is having Miss McKeon and Mr. Pratt," their English teacher and their history teacher, both of whom were leaving the school. They put this on a big public sign right out on Bathurst Avenue, which is sort of a big thoroughfare. I was struck by this as a lyric personal use of a public medium. I knew it was going to happen sooner or later. I never heard of it happening before. It's like taking a Coke ad and turning it into a personal sonnet to one's wife. And using a public form for private expression. Now, this comes naturally to this TV generation. They're not the least bit inhibited by public media. They accept them as their personal language. Private.
I did the tribute to my mother when she died on radio. On my program the next morning.
There is an American film with Julie Holliday in which she buys a billboard in Times Square and puts her own name on it to become famous.
I remember that.
Somebody has used this as a way of getting his wife to come back to him, use the billboard.
Yeah. Well, it's like the English, come to think of it, have used the front page of the Times for many years for personals, strictly personal information. Come back and all will be forgiven on page one of the Times. They've used, in other words, news, public news, as private message. But they've suddenly dropped it after many, many years,
Marshall,
which is a great mistake.
Suppose I give you two pages out of a magazine and pay you for it to do a want ad page for what you expect of the visual and sound people of our time. Would you do it?
Sure, it would be nice if I could get some of these other books written first. I'm not going to take on any more assignments until I've got my obligations attended to. I really have a lot of work to get done.
What were some of the other points?
Apropos of your idea of world as studio, look in the same way at the total world environment as campus for learning. Dialogue can now take place, again, with aids of the tape recorder type, anywhere in the world. Any part, under the water, above the earth. Look how much human interest is now coming out of these capsules. Anything said in that environment is top human interest. But human interest, by the way, means involvement. as opposed to news story. A story is not human interest. That is, an ordinary news story is not human interest. It has to have a certain dimension for involvement where you can complete the rest of the factors yourself. This is true in pictures. You see, the pictures that permit a high degree of fill-in, like that one, you see, larger portrait there, compared to the snapshots up there, there's much more to fill in photographically with your senses. It's more abstract. Abstract art means leaving a lot of things out so that you can get into the picture.
You know, I am struck by something very unusual. You always go like this when you say involved.
Yeah, because...
Now, all right, wait.
Telescope.
I walk down the street, and when I see guys go like this, I think of the same... That, you know, and it's the same involvement in a way. You know, I mean, it's a very involving situation.
No,
I'm serious. Yeah. There is the involvement in both situations.
Well, when people do gesture, it is because they are using all the senses at once. You know, they've discovered that kids with reading difficulties can be helped by getting them on the trampoline. And when they get using all their muscles, that can overcome visual difficulties. That merely when they're trying to isolate one of their senses, they get into troubles that they can overcome by using all their senses. Well, in many of these backward territories like France and Italy, they use all their senses. They gesticulate wildly.
Gee, that's fascinating. That explains something. In Wall Street Journal this week, there's a item about a golf school, a famous golf school. They will sell you for $499 a movie camera and give you instructions in being a photographer so you can take your own picture. So maybe through the vision, making a movie, you can become a better golfer.
That's right.
Oh,
I'm sure you could. It's by feedback. You see, what happens, feedback is a form of profound involvement. Anything that loops back and brings you in to the whole process again.
I said today in a commercial we were working on, make a mistake and leave it in. I say, first off, we get the client interested by doing it.
Oh, yeah.
But let's leave it in the commercial. Make a mistake that doesn't affect us. People will be calling in, be involved in this commercial.
You see, the correctness is mechanical. Any correct flowing performance is purely mechanical compared to a mistake.
The dropping of the sound of the dropping of the lid. 4 seconds later.
Oh, here's one for you.
Well,
there's a chap at Rochester who had the curiosity to put a mic in the crib of a small infant to pick up all the sounds that a small infant hears.
I have done that. All the talk that people speak to.
Well, listen, guess what? Guess what came out?
The icebox.
The icebox door is the overwhelming sound that any small child hears. Not traffic, not voices. The icebox. Clonk. Over and over again. Yeah, how about that?
What were some of the other points?
It's an environmental sound. Greek movies. Have you ever watched one? Like Electra or Medea? Well, there are quite a few modern Greek movies. And try one. And you'll find that they do them, these tragedies, out of doors, the way we do Westerns. And they at once become plausible. Tragic emotions make sense at once you get out of an enclosed theatrical space, into the out of doors. The form of the emotion then becomes environmental. It isn't just private anymore. It becomes a typical role-like emotion. It really is a very great experience. Now, our Westerns, you see, have that power of using the out-of-doors, unenclosed space for shaping emotion. It's like your clarinetist. By using the out-of-doors for the shaping of emotion, they come up with a pattern of emotion that people find immediately plausible, meaningful, involving. Now, no legit theater has this resource. It can't go near that dimension of legitimate tragic emotion. So that the Westerns, the out-of-door shows, have a tremendous lot of resources utterly untouched by the indoor theater or indoor movie. And, they don't have sets, you see. In the Greek movies, there are no sets. They just use the damn rocks and the ground. And... just as in a Western, there are no sets, except when they rush into town. But, that dimension, the changing of the image, photographic or in any sense, by getting away from enclosed spaces. And same with sound, really. You were explaining that you get away from the enclosed and the sound takes on a new dimension altogether. There's a tremendous world for you to keep in mind. You probably have thought about it. Linguistics. In terms of the creative use of the tape recorder, the whole science of linguistics has come out of it. Because with the tape recorder, it became possible to arrest, isolate certain rhythms, patterns, and study them, play them back. Linguistics is a study not of semantics or word meanings, but of gestures and rhythms of language. A complete new dimension of speech has opened up with the tape recorder. And now it becomes possible to know why children are able to learn their mother tongue in 3 or 4 years. Because the kids don't approach objects by semantics. It isn't the meaning of words that they first get, it's the rhythm, the patterns of syntax and so on. They don't get it grammatically or by understanding what it means. They get it by straight involvement in the rhythm and by using that rhythm themselves then as a toy to play around the world with. They try it out, they repeat it, they repeat it, they repeat it. So, linguistics, which is a pretty exciting world of new study, came straight out of tape recording. Impossible without it. And, of course, without the mobility and portability of the tape recorder, you couldn't do linguistic study. But I just scribbled those down as we went, but there's lots that...
They haven't begun to use the... Interestingly, they don't use the recorder as a creative tool in the study of linguistics yet. Very few people. I mean, I imagine it's 1 in 1,000,000 that puts the recorder in the crib to see what the
baby says. Oh, yeah, that's right.
They're using it in the school, in the classroom, in a confined... little box that the person sits in the space capsule, you know, and that's where the study...
Make a note of this book. I think you'd find a lot of interest in it. It's called The Lore and Language of School Children by Mr. and Mrs. Opie, O-P-I-E. I think it's Oxford Press. But it's a study of the actual songs, games, phrases, slang, jokes, gags, everything that kids use in the schoolyard. Now, when they began this study, or rather the result of the study, they discovered that in Melbourne, Australia, or Belfast, Ireland, or in the Bronx, the same jokes, games, gags, and the same as had been going on for centuries, because these things are not taught by adults to children, but by children to children.
Yes, I say that in the collection of folklore. I say that the transmission era is 2 or 3 years as opposed to the generation, because it's from kid to kid rather from adult to child.
But the paradox is that it's static. It never changes. This oral form is very conservative.
If we were to follow this, you would destroy the grammar textbook as Well, the word hot to a child is a noun, stove is an adjective.
Yeah, but look, no child ever made a mistake in slang. You only make a mistake...
It's not slang, it's meaning. The word hot is more important than what the object that is hot to a child.
Grammatical errors begin with the written word. When you try to translate the spoken word into written form, there are masses of grammatical errors in the translation. When you merely stick with a spoken word, slang, no mistakes. Now, slang is not easy. It's tricky, it's subtle, it's full of nuance, but no child ever made a mistake. It's like saying no native ever made a mistake in grammar.
You know, it's interesting. This fits into...
Anthropologists make mistakes in grammar, but natives don't make grammatical errors.
This is interesting. This fits into your idea that you can take the new furniture and you can't take the new furniture and put it into the old, but you can take the old furniture and put it into the new.
That's right.
In that...
That's the rearview mirror.
You can take any speech, and it's correct grammatically, and yet if you took and said what was written, you can make mistakes.
That's right, because if you ask the kids to write down their slang, they couldn't do it. It's translating from sound into sight that creates the grammatical problem. Well, your question then is more or less in that area. As we move more and more into a sound world, the boundaries between sight and sound, or written and oral, tend to disappear. More and more. In the same way with photography, it can go across boundaries of any kind. The boundaries that previously of public and private disappear. It invades areas that previously were inviolate and creates new environment of awareness and imagery.
I wish you weren't so committed to some of these projects, because I'd like to expose you to some people in the photo site. For instance, Bruce Davidson, he just completed a project with his students in making a visual vote for Lindsay.
Uh-huh.
They translated why they voted for him with a camera to be stuck in under his nose to see if he's accomplished this.
What nice that happened as a result? What, I mean, what did they turn up with?
It's about to happen in the second stage now. But there's such fascinating overlaps between sound, politics, and all the things we're talking about. And everybody in New York has a little hand, not often. Tony's got two hands on one. There's nobody like
you. Know the kids joke about what do you see when you lift up an elephant's tail? The engine. Trunk's up front. Yeah, I'd rely on the kids for most of my jokes.
You know, I would love to do a movie where I take the character of words that people say. For instance, I use the word a lot. You know, I say
very expressive.
Now, people, I'm doing a tape for Lindsay. He does this in his public appearances, and it cuts down his effect tremendously. So I'm doing a tape taking his speeches and showing him if he just were to cut out his uhs. First, I'm going to give him all his uhs first. Then show him that if he cut out his uhs, how his image changes just by doing this. And I have some Seymour Siegel's giving him.
You see what would happen if he said, uh-huh, instead of uh-huh. This would make him a very sharp guy. A guy who's always making discoveries.
He'd be like a psychiatrist.
Now, you see, the moment is the moment of eureka. I got it. Uh-huh. That's all you have to tell him. Just stop this stuff and say, uh-huh. Boy. Got it made.
Barry Brown, I think. It wasn't you, I'm sure, said that the word that's, or the phrase that's interesting, is a cop-out. It leaves you without saying anything and getting out of it.
Oh, yes, this is what you say to a person. What do you think of this painting?
What you say? Very interesting. Next question. Very interesting. Next question,
please. I heard
another
one, yes. I made a tape for someone. He played it to an actor, and he was very much interested in his reaction, his acting, this guy's acting. Another fellow says, very sensitive. Now, that's another one.
Another one is to go whistle, low whistle. Much better than any verbalizer. There you go. But
no, but you see, there are people, I have recordings of people where I'll record an hour of them, and through it there are 50 or 100. So he says to me, he says, so I says to him, I says. Or another one will say,
you see what I mean?
And it wasn't either one of them.
And I want to take out those lines and do a film with these words becoming the characters. So one guy is Mr. You see what I mean? You know, and he goes through life just saying, you see what I mean? You see what I mean? Another, you get children who say, well, well, well.
That sounds like Marvin.
Pencil.
Have you heard this new song that we heard in the cab today about Marvin?
On this.
No, oh, you will hear it. You will hear it. There's a new song, this great big hit overnight, all about Marvin.
Who's that fuzzy fella? I didn't give him credit. Didn't credit him with this. What's his name? The
Alan Sherman.
Alan Sherman. Yeah. It sounds like one of his.
By the way, you know the film Never to Return, Canadian Film Board, Dropout?
No.
Well, in it they have one sequence where a student raises a gun to kill his teacher. And a classroom bell goes off. And I was wondering if that's what you were referring to.
As an effect of what kind?
The bell business before.
Oh, well, no, the bell that the community bell, the tolling bell, has a tremendous inclusive sound. No, the alarm bell doesn't include nobody. That means beat it. And the classroom bell means get up. you see, it's high pitch. The community bell has to be a low bong.
Did I tell you I'm taking a class in oral perception next year, and I'm taking all dropouts? I believe that they're essentially dropouts.
And I heard a little speech yesterday at a conference by Alan Lloyd of McGraw-Hill, and he was showing the effects of using typewriters, instructing with typewriters in classrooms. And he said, the poorer the student, the more they improve, the more they gain from this. And that is only another way of saying that the poorer students are really people who use all their senses. And the better students are people who have succeeded in specializing in visual life, just pulling the eye out from the other senses. That's the top student in our world. Doesn't mean that he's brainy, it just means that he's specialist in his sensory life. Now, this happens in Toronto. There's a conundrum connected with the observed fact that the slow grades 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 are the ones who learn to speak French quickly. The fast grades, the top people, never learn to speak it. You can't learn to speak a language by eye. So it's these dumbbells who use all their senses who learn French. They can get at it with all their senses. You see, you learn a language mainly by ear and by rhythm. I have a French friend who says there are no words in French, there are only rhythms. It makes it difficult for an English person to hear French. No words. Just rhythm. But the linguist says this is true of all languages, that basically they are rhythms and not words.
How many languages do you speak?
I could make out a little bit of French, that's about all. How about you?
Well, some hillbilly Russian and English.
Oh, well, I can talk a lot of dialects. I have no trouble with dialects. It's just that I've never studied languages. I'm a monolingual guy. Well, I've always had a great facility with picking up the local dialect in Ireland or Texas or Devonshire or anywhere. Well, it's easier to do it when you're sort of in the environment. But you need to get the rhythm feeling. It gets going, you know. But after all, I have a Texas wife, and it isn't too hard for me to do Texas. But she, in turn, does many other dialects, you know, except she prefers the Alabama or the Georgian or Mississippi or anything to Texas. But and notice the new TV generation kids, they love putting on dialects. They love to mimic dialects. I don't remember kids doing that in my time. Now, I think you'll find that empathy, TV is an empathic. Well, that just as radio was added to silent pictures as soundtrack, so TV has tended to retain the movie soundtrack, which is a radio form, in spite of the fact that the images for which the sound is provided have nothing in common. So I haven't tried to imagine myself what should be the soundtrack for TV. It would certainly not be a hi-fi sound like radio or gramophone. It might well be more in the electronic music vein. It might. I don't know. There's no reason why you can't have different sorts of soundtracks. But it hasn't occurred to anybody to work out a soundtrack for TV that would be completely different from the movie one. It's somewhat like this, though, that just as the movie used as its content the old medium, every new medium uses as its content the old one, And the movie used the novel as storyline, and TV went on using the movie storyline, despite the fact it is not a narrative medium.
The one difference that I see possible is the fact that you can take... I find the greater tendency and the more success just comes from using sound and counterpoint to image rather than using
matching.
You see, that's one area.
Because counterpoint is making, not magic. You make, and when you make something, this involves the participant or the viewer very much more than just matching. Matching, though, is a normal activity for the visual world. It is not a natural activity for the auditory or the other senses.
Could you give me the line, just in simple English, that the medium is the message?
The medium is the message is another perfect example of any medium using the old medium as content. The medium creates an environment that is a sort of infallible teaching machine that works on the sensory life of the population. And so if you substitute for message, massage, you get the idea that what the medium does is to make a new environment that really works into the whole innards of people and massages them. It's a process. The medium is a process. The content is not. It's the old medium that had already done the massaging long ago. Now, the new medium is a new massage treatment, and the content is always the old medium, as with silence or whatnot on TV.
You say it always is?
Always, yes. I don't know of any exceptions. See, when Plato began to write down words for the first time, he wrote down the old oral tradition. He wrote down the words of Socrates, who belonged to the previous culture. And this goes right on through. The first 200 years of printing did nothing but print medieval literature.
Right, but then what about the after that?
The same. You see, it's like the horseless carriage. It's the old buggy dolled up, put the horse in the cart, and away we go. I was thinking just today about the a phrase for the safety car is rocking the bandwagon, because what the safety car amounts to is putting the public in the carriage, and by the time the public now insists on being included in the carriage in order to feel safe, and this in effect rocks the bandwagon all to bits. It's the end of the car. The safety car equals end of car. The dead. Oh, well. It would be nice if nothing would take its place for a while. But the chances are we're going to have three-dimensional transportation. After all, we live in the age of the rocket, the jet, the airplane. Why we haven't had three-dimensional transportation at all levels long ago, I don't know, but... Vertical. You know, after all, the horizontal transportation is now ancient history. And the new speeds of the society are all adjusting to non-horizontal. You know the discomfort that people feel in going to and from airports. There's something wrong. Everybody feels this shouldn't happen. I'm only going to fly for an hour once I get off the ground, and here it takes me over an hour to get out there. Something wrong. But, anyway, any medium creates an environment. The environment is a process that just twists the guts of people. That's the message.
The essence of folklore, and write folk songs about their life, they go to other musics. They go to mountain music. They go to...
No, that's partly rearview mirror. It's easier to see things at a distance in another culture. If you ask a kid, a freshman in a school, to write an autobiography of themselves, it's impossible. They have no image of themselves at all. They can give a few statistics, and they just... I always say I'm just an ordinary kid. I went to high school, and now here I am in college, and that's it. That's all they can see of themselves. But they could see their neighbors, they could see other people much more clearly. Autobiography is very difficult because the image we form of ourselves is invisible, except to others. You see, from moment to moment, we make an image based on what we hear and feel and see. We make a body image of ourselves all the time. From every waking moment, we have a body image. It's changing. It's invisible. You can't see it. It's total environment. It is so total that it's invisible. All environments, though, are invisible.
Esquire conducted an experiment in one December issue where they asked famous people to do a sketch of themselves and answer seven questions at any length. And it was very revealing. Whatever anyone did, Fred Astaire did the longest one, and very revealing about himself. But if you can tie it down to specific questions, I think you can hit at this rather than letting them loose.
There you go. You better turn that back on. It's getting real warm in here. I'm very grateful for the voice in having it all. One of the things I was in Washington recently, I find that everywhere you go is air conditioned, and it's terribly hard on the voice, terribly hard on allergies, which I seem to experience. Yeah, it was good to get out of there. Well, I'll look at the bag when it comes and think about it. But I don't exhaust areas that I study. I just sample. I look for contours, structures. I don't fill them in.
I'm with you. This is exactly what we need.
Well, what would be interesting to know, what are some of the key changes in photography that have occurred in, say, the last 10 years?
You have to see it. Really try. Have you ever shot a Polaroid picture?
No, I've seen friends do it all the time.
Have you ever made a videotape?
I have, actually.
Have you ever seen yourself on 21 screens at
no,
the same time?
No, heaven forbid.
No, I think that
after
if we
all,
get a happening,
even Hercules,
in a short time.
Even Hercules only had to clean the Augean stables once. 21 times. Boy, what a thing to wipe off. But, you know, by the way, this is inherent in TV more than in movie, multiple screens, is because when you have multiple screen, you don't have a storyline. The movie favors storyline much more than TV. TV doesn't need storyline. It's more iconic. It can deal with the separate, unconnected screens much better than...
Now you're referring to Eames, IBM, right?
No, I'm not referring to anything, just structure. That the nature of TV favors multiple screens. It is being held to the one screen by movie form, rear view mirror. What's this one about? I think, where am I going? What's this one
about? This is about the Electronic Museum.
Huh?
Read a little of that. This is Alan Schwanger's.
One of the things. Oh, well. Can't talk about everything. No, it's just about two. The Electronic Museum made by whom?
Well, no, this is his idea of what the computer can do to museums.
Yeah. Oh, I know. I've been thinking about it.
By the way, we're sending the first Marshall McLuhan care package to Europe.
What's that mean?
Gutenberg Galaxy, Messages Medium, and four-year speeches to several photographers who just aren't with it and are kind of stuck.
Wow.
And I'm anxious to use your word to hear what the feedback is going to be.
Well, spare me. I can imagine. The son of a gun, Jerry Stern, is printing a whole batch of violently hostile book reviews of Gutenberg Galaxy and Understanding Media in a book.
Great.
And he's making comments, and I'm making comments on each of the reviews as we go. In other words, we're using these as a means of revealing all sorts of things.
If I were you, I would show up in the Village Voice office some afternoon.
I never read that. I heard about it.
Why don't you just show up there and ask him for the copies? You upset that whole damn place.
But
do that as dessert something.
Okay, I'll do that. Would I need a bodyguard?
No.
No, the guy who wrote that, I assume, was the sort of guy who, one afternoon at NYU when I was on a panel, it was the afternoon I got soaking wet and had to go onto the platform in the evening with my wet, these clothes soaking wet. I couldn't, Saturday afternoon you can't get any pressing done in New York, literally. I mean, that's not a figure of speech. I spent $4.50 in a cab going around every pressing establishment in New York City. And valet services at Grand Central everywhere, no hope. This little guy, in between these miseries that I went through that day, he kept barging in, trying to get something from me. And I said, well, look, I'm going to be speaking tonight. And have you read my books? He says, no. Well, I'll be saying a lot of things that are in the books tonight on this speech and so on. Why don't you let that go for an interview? Oh, I guess it made him real mad. But anyway, he was a real nuisance. Boy, he was a nuisance all that afternoon. And because I was in public, there was no privacy. And so I guess this happened as a result. Doesn't do any harm, does it?
Not at all. You are fine, these guys. For a while, you were going off there with no blocks, nobody standing in your way, and it was too good to be true. It couldn't happen today. As these guys build up, you'll get stronger. You'll be more fascinating.
You know, one of the amazing things about the computer that it's all now being set to do the old job. Even museums, you see, are merely storage systems. The real power of the computer is as a source of discovery. That is, when by interface you retrieve information at high speeds, you can, by banging various things against each other, reveal all sorts of structural facts about them that were completely hidden before. Now, this is true in language, which is a retrieval system also. When you recall things cockeyed, you usually make discoveries. That's when the pun or the slip of speech comes up to aid in discovery. And slip of the tongue is usually a revealing moment.
People say to me, you lost a lot of weight. You must take a lot of willpower. I say, no, it takes willpower. I won't eat this. I won't eat that. I had willpower before. I will eat that. I will eat that. It takes willpower.
Marshall, can we have a visual church? Can we replace the pulpit with a screen and all the icons with TV sets?
Well, TV as a liturgical means is far more potent than actual presence in the church. In following the Mass, for example, most Catholics feel right off in their first encounter with it on TV that they had never really seen it before. It's much more participative than being in the church. It's like the church, very much like the concert hall, full of distractions, lateral, horizontal distractions of other people in crazy clothes and crazy voices and crazy everything. This creates a huge distraction that TV eliminates. This having what effect do you have in mind? Oh, you tend to be more isolated then, the dark theater.
We have a church in Greenwich Village where it's given over to artists. Jazz musicians play a mass that they created themselves.
Folk mass.
They just sit down and they there are movies in there that they think.
Have you spoken to them?
To whom?
Have you spoken to this church?
No. William Glenesk's church. It's a Presbyterian one over in Brooklyn.
No, that's not it.
Yes, this is in the village.
No. I'm just wondering how, and if maybe in Canada this has been applied there.
Well, in backward countries you can do things that you can't do in more advanced countries because, literally, there's a bigger backlog, you see, of applied and conventional wisdom to overcome before you can do anything new. In areas where they haven't tried to do anything new ever, you don't have the same obstacles to overcome in innovation. It's like Ghana or somewhere like that. You can race ahead into the 20th century there far faster than you can in Brooklyn or New York. There's no backlog of technology.
You don't have to close down.
There's no technology to obstruct whatever.
Well, All right, can I ask you a question about Ghana? Can we develop a system of closed-circuit justice since there is a shortage of lawyers and judges?
No, you have to face the fact you can't put the old judicial procedures on a new medium. You can't have a jury trial by jury on TV. The relation
closed circuit where their judge is
the point is that the involvement of the people in each other is different from their involvement in, as in this room, their relation to one another changes.
So electronic
they're in show business. The moment they go onto TV, they're in show business.
And aren't lawyers in show business continually?
Yeah, but there are some people in the court who are supposed not to be. The judge and the jury are not supposed to be in show business. On TV, they are. And they act accordingly. Changes their whole relation to the victim.
You're against cameras in the court of any kind.
No. I'm merely telling you what happens.
I'm probing.
It changes the whole nature of judicial procedure. It would not be the same in a few months. Everything would have been rearranged.
It changes the size of the show.
It, I'm sure. Well, look,
did you ever see the
we have to get going.
Did you ever read the story, the situation where the defense attorney wanted to take away the attention of the jury while the prosecuting attorney, he stuck a wire paper clip inside his cigar, just stood there smoking, and let the ash hang long, and the whole jury was watching that ash. When did that fall?
You know, this happened in a PhD. This happened in a PhD oral. The student put a great big sort of knitting needle in his cigar and held the ash on from beginning to end of his oral, hypnotized his examiners. They were helpless.
Where are these guys today? Well, that's great stuff. Imagine a commercial you can do with this. Why don't you apply it to a commercial?
It's for Groucho.
Why?
Yeah, you're right.
See, this, I have a friend who should know about this. I should make this little note. It's Art in America, March, April. Art in America, March, April, 66. Electronic Museum.
Harley should know about
it. Yeah, Harley. Harley Parker is doing a book on museums, past, present, future, and with his eye on unused potential. Well, it's been fun. But, I'll see you here. I'll see you when I get back next week.
Okay, I'll get up some demonstrations of material. Maybe if I can even work on them before next week.
Why don't you let them help out?
They've
got a great library staff there and resources.
They won't be related.
Well, no, but ask them to get some material to show changing visual image with soundtrack.
Well, that I think I can take some things that I have both for.
If you can save yourself some bother.
Well, I have
it
all.
Oh, that's right. Thank you very much.
Good show.
Is that the museum on?
Can you stay here?
Yeah. Well, this is so fascinating. We haven't even scratched the surface.
That's true.
I hope one time we can get together with some of the pictures that we're involved in around. See you again.
Suddenly have an idea for an RIT.
You also have to have a YouTube game or something. Oh, Charlie Arnold's one of his teachers, I bet. Is he graduating this year?
Thanks,
Tony.
Yeah, one more year to go.
Send him down, will you?
Wow.
Oh, right.
We're very close to
Paul Hattersley, who used to be one of the best writers.
Dear sucker, Jack.
And,
have him come right there.
Okay. It's a hell of a feel, boy. As you probably know from your involvement.
Yeah. I'll be around until 5 o'clock, and I'll be out from 5 to 7:30.
Well. that just as radio was added to silent pictures as soundtrack, so TV has tended to retain the movie soundtrack, which is a radio form, in spite of the fact that the images for which the sound is provided have nothing in common. I haven't tried to imagine myself what should be the soundtrack for TV.